What's it like to be disabled in the age of high tech? While there's no doubt modern technology provides a great deal of accessibility and opportunity, many disability activists think real solutions lie elsewhere, according to Ashley Hsu, the author of Against Techno-Ableism, Rethinking Who Needs Improvement. Ashley is a professor at Virginia Tech who specializes in disability studies and technology ethics. Here she is to share five of her big ideas.
Hi, this is Ashley Hsu, author of Against Techno-Ableism, Rethinking Who Needs Improvement. I'm an associate professor of science, technology, and society at Virginia Tech. And perhaps more importantly to my work in this book, I'm multiply disabled and an active participant in my local disability groups. I also think a lot about technology as a philosopher of technology. I've been asked to share five key insights from my book. This is a short book and part of the Norton Short series, so specifically written that way. As a scholar, however, I will probably still ramble on for the entirety of my time. You've been warned. Insight one, what you think you know about disability is probably wrong. And the stories that you've been given have given you a misperception. As someone who became disabled at age 30, even though I thought I knew a lot of things, I was not really aware of how every day would be. I remember being so shocked prior to age 30 and acquiring my disability that no one came to help a wheelchair-using friend who was parked in with her lift-equipped van. Someone parked in the hashed aisle where her wheelchair van lift would lower to let her in. No one would come help. No tow was sent to come get this car. And it was so frustrating to watch. And I thought at the time that things would work. But the reality is that disabled people are much more accustomed to having to figure out things out themselves. Because, in fact, no one is coming to help. And disabled people don't get the credit they deserve for the workarounds and the work they have to do to get the access that they have. I expected that there were systems that there simply weren't systems for. Disabled people are often forced to navigate hostile waters among do-gooders who simply don't understand our experiences. I know I didn't always get it. Insight two, you have to be wary of common tropes about disability. I talk about these in my book, but five common narrative tropes are pitiful freaks, shameful sinners, moochers and fakers, bitter cripples, and inspirational overcomers. So often the stories that are told about disability emphasize these commonly occurring tropes or biases. With a trope like moochers and fakers at play, disabled people are policed when we use disability services, disability parking, or other accommodations. So many news stories paint ADA lawsuits as frivolous, even though they are rare and difficult to win. This trope leads many disabled people to being afraid to use things that would actually really help them and level the playing field around them, like extra time on tests in an educational setting or disability parking, because it makes people scrutinize them so much more to use the accessibility features and accommodations that should be working for them. The trope of pitiful freaks, as another example, plays out in so many narratives told by supposedly charitable organizations that paint particular disabilities as awful or pitiful and calling out for your intervention and your donations. Charitable events like the Muscular Dystrophy Association's long-running telethons or advertisements like some of what Autism Speaks has put out have spread messages about their respective target groups that some people call bewareness instead of awareness. And it's led people to be more afraid of the disabling condition that's being targeted than they might have been before. Disability activists have long protested the Muscular Dystrophy Association and Autism Speaks because of these tactics. For another trope like bitter cripples, what we're talking about is all the depictions that you've seen of villainy that involve things like facial scars or hook hand prosthetics, indicating in plays and things like that how twisted a disabled character is. This is a long-running trope that precedes modern cinema in many ways. And it means the result of a trope like this means that for hand amputees, they're less likely to use hook tools, which can actually be really useful for a lot of things. But often hand amputees will avoid using these because children find them frightening. This trope is so early embedded in children, but exists in all sorts of media around us. I won't go into detail on all the tropes, but I want to say that these tropes end up setting the scene upon which disabled people are encountered and misunderstood. Insight 3. These narrative tropes end up dominating the conversation, even when we're talking about technology stories where disabled people are just users. And many narratives don't give us a realistic image about what being disabled is like at all. They are often stories curated to please non-disabled people or encourage newly disabled people from a non-disabled's perspective, what they think would be encouraging. So many stories about disabled people start with these different tropes or biases as the frame from which they see disabled people, and we are almost always represented as lone disabled individuals, separate and separated from each other. But we know cross-disability friendship and collaboration improves the lives of disabled people. Studies show that disabled people indicate having a higher quality of life just by knowing other disabled people and participating in disability groups. We rarely witness anything on screen or in the news where disabled people interact with one another. Even the story of Helen Keller, which is usually told only about her youth, depicts Annie Sullivan as the miracle worker. And I want to say, literally, the biographical movie about Helen Keller is called The Miracle Worker. Helen doesn't get to be the headline in her very own story. Instead, it tells a story of a helpful helper helping and connecting Helen Keller back to the world. And before that, she's depicted as wild and throwing things around and unruly. What you don't hear about, it elides the fact that Annie Sullivan is legally blind, and the two of them are lifelong friends and participate in different types of socialist and progressive organizing together. Insight 4, disability community isn't what you think. Disability community isn't one thing, and it's huge and intersectional, and so many stories are almost never told. Most disabled people are multiply disabled, meaning having more than one disability, like me. So it's super rare that most of our stories have disabled characters that are supposed to represent one disability only, when most of us hold many. This means that disabled people of color are underserved by the narratives we're given. And it means that when we have technological projects, when people think about how the project will benefit disabled people, they're usually framing it in terms of white disabled users only. And this sort of focus really covers over the incredible role Black, Indigenous, and Asian disabled people played during the disability civil rights era, and that play in every facet of disabled existence. There were disabled Black Panthers that were a critical force in disability organizing during the 504 sit-ins, some of the longest sit-ins in American history. During the ADA 30 celebration, that would be the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, Alice Wong and her team at the Disability Visibility Project really were trying to highlight, and it's called hashtag ADA30 in color, to let disabled people of color talk about the anniversary and what it meant, but also what the ADA has not meant, and how the main beneficiaries of the Americans with Disabilities Act are often more financially secure white disabled people. Insight 5, disabled people are inventive and deserve appreciation beyond the tropey nonsense we usually see. Our stories are much more nuanced and sometimes in your face and not aimed at pleasing non-disabled people. We build and invent for each other and for ourselves. Disabled creativity shows up in different arts movements, but also in how we tell our stories and what we make for ourselves and each other. I'm continually learning new life skills, learning about hearing aid skins that I can buy from other disabled people on Etsy to make my hearing aids extra fancy and to let them stand out on my head. I'm learning from my friends with ADHD how to use the alarms on my phone so that I show up on time for things because my sense of time has been totally destroyed by chemo brain. I'm learning from neurodivergent and chronically ill folks about thinking more flexibly and forgivingly about time and productivity, and to value my body and mind and respect their boundaries. And I'm learning so much more. Also, we're telling a lot of jokes and enjoying each other. We learn about new tech and repurpose technologies for our own use, and we maintain older tech sometimes together, learning from one another what works, what doesn't, how we can change different settings, how we can change our own lives through community, through understanding, and not just through technology. I tell my classes that ableism is the sauce we're all marinated in. Part of my work with Against Techno-Ableism is to force recognition of certain forms of ableism that seem so prevalent, especially in the sphere of technology, where technologies are often celebrated as cure-alls for disability. But these stories about technology and disability often do a disservice to disabled people, taking away recognition of our agency, autonomy, and frankly, our ability to be seen as regular people, which is what we are. I hope I do this in a fun and funny way in the book, and I hope you love it. Thanks so much for listening.
Thank you, Ashley. That was 5 Big Ideas from Against Techno-Ableism, Rethinking Who Needs Improvement by Ashley Hsu. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.